Hey folks, welcome to the Wrench Turners Podcast, the show that's about improving the life, well-being, and productivity of mechanics everywhere. I am your host, Joshua Taylor, founder of Wrench Turners Online. And today we have a very special guest. We have Aaron Bratcher, a very, very experienced service leader. So without further ado, let's get into it. Aaron, thank you very much for taking a few minutes and coming on this evening and having a little bit of a recording, a little chat session with me.
Thanks, Joshua. I appreciate you having me on.
No worries. I'm looking forward to some of your tidbits because I know the little bit of the repartee that happens in SDL that's happened over probably the last 2 years. I see the little bits and pieces every once in a while. I see, you know, there's the running gag there for a while where we only ever saw the one side of your head because you were always working on Sunday morning. So we got the camera was facing one way. We got the side of the head while you were working. It's like, does he actually have Two-Face? Is he Scarface? Do we like what's going on here? And then eventually we got to see the other side of the face. But I always
knew my left side was the good side. So I just wanted to, you know, staring at my computer doing my work on Sunday morning, and then just kind of keeping you guys. Okay, look, this is the good side.
Well, that leads us into a whole thing. If you know that there's a good side, and the fact that there's a story even to that means that the stories are good from the beginning. So let's go way back. Let's go way back to when you started. Now, given that you've got a little bit more gray than I do, we're going to assume that you're younger than I am, right? So you've been around the block a few times.
A little bit.
So what got you into the business? What got you into the trade?
I think when I was working at, I was just working at a quick oil change place. And, you know, I wanted to, you know, have an opportunity to do more. And a friend of mine was a parts guy at a Ford dealership and said that they were looking for an oil change guy. So, put my application in, and you got to understand this Ford dealership is, now it's probably, it is a little bit bigger, but, it's a monster dealership, but it has cornfield in three different directions. So, it was way out in the middle of nowhere, Ford and Chevy house. I mean, great place. And, I got my first job there as just the oil change guy. And you know, that was my eye opening to the business, very much. Being the guy on the bottom end of the totem pole making $7.25 an hour. That was great. And that was
you heard it here, folks. All of you young lads that are balking that I hear, $15 an hour minimum wage and all the rest of this, like, go back a while. Let's go back a while. Aaron and I started when it was single digit. There was a single digit in that minimum wage many moons ago. I think my first professional, we'll call it professional, when I started working was like six flat.
Yeah. I'd probably been there probably about 2 years. I think I was there about 3 years total, and I was there about two and a half years. I said, you know, I've been here a long time. At the time, Ford only had so many online courses. I took all those online courses and I said, you know, I kind of want a raise. And so they put me at $7.50. So I got a quarter.
Five nickels.
I thought, woohoo. But at the time I had my own apartment. I had my own car. I had all my own bills. So I had a part-time job that I made almost twice as much money part-time as I did rather than my full-time job. It's pretty pathetic.
You got to love what you do if you're gonna have to live with that. You got to love what you do to live with that. Working two jobs. Man,
it was rough. It was rough at first, you know, with one of the advisors was the service manager's son. And so, he thought, I can't be touched. You know, I can do whatever I want. So he used to walk out to my stall. I'd be changing oil, doing whatever. And he'd walk out there and he goes, you know what? I think I've had enough of you. I think I'm going to go talk to my dad. I'm going to get you fired today. All right.
What?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the tech that was working next to me, his name is Vernon. Great guy. You know, he always kind of looked out for me a little bit. He always tried to teach me stuff. He was an electrical guy. And he knew that the family. And he walked over and he'd go, hey, why don't you go back in your office and shut up? And of course, the guy just turned around and walked, you know. And so, you know, fast forward, you know, so many years later, when I get the opportunity and I go into writing service, and I think back to that. And I thought, man, I hate service advisors. That guy used to tell me all the time, I'm going to get you fired and I hate you, you know. And I thought, well, you know what? I'll just be a different service advisor. I won't be like that. But yeah, I did not. So that Ford dealership would never send me to training class ever. They said that just because I was the oil change guy, even though since I was hourly, I was expected to do, you know, as normal, as I've seen for so long, and I've had guys do this, oil change guys, you're hourly, you sweep the shop, you help the other techs. I was pulling engines, I was pulling transmissions. In 2003, 2004, 2005, somewhere around there, Ford had a recall on their reverse gears, mm-hmm. on their three-quarter tons. I was pulling transmissions open to close because the transmission guy was so behind, and mm-hmm. I could get a transmission out in, you know, 4 hours or whatever, which is, you know, for a green, you know, 22-year-old guy, you know, with no real tools or training to be able to do it was not that bad. Yeah. But eventually, you know, I thought, well, I'm not going to go anywhere here. They're not going to send me to class. They're not going to push me to do any more training because there's no more training I can do. I've done it all. Well, there's really nowhere for me to go here. So I guess it was time to move on.
Okay. So, you know, it was interesting. A couple of things in there. Didn't Joe say this morning on SDLs, don't let your apprentices become somebody's bitch?
Yeah.
Right. Like that's one of the fundamental things that every service leader should ever, like, one of the things you should be thinking about. Yes, you got apprentices, and yes, extracting what you can financially from them is kind of one of those things that you kind of want to do as a service leader. You've got apprentices that first couple of years, get some money out of them, so to speak.
Yeah.
But at the same time, as much as an apprentice can so completely help a journeyman that's been around for 20 years, that's probably got bad knees already, probably got a bad back already, just holding a wrench or just taking out the trash or just pushing a broom isn't going to help you keep that person long term, as you're describing, right? You know, there's only so much somebody can do to be held down, basically held underwater, saying, hey, you're not allowed to advance. You're not, you know, you got another person saying, it's like, I don't like you. I'm going to get you fired. And then you've got the leader saying, you know, we're not going to send you to more training, or we're not going to send you any training. Like, that's, you know, from a large picture, you know, if there's anybody out there listening, which I doubt very much any of the folks that listen to Wrench Nerds podcast are in this category, but if you've experienced this kind of atmosphere, this is what we're talking about when we talk about being in toxic environments, right?
Yes.
Right? Sometimes there's the only thing you can really do is leave, which is incredibly unfortunate.
You know, it's I've been back to visit that dealership. I think I was there probably 4 months ago, 7 months ago, and got to see some people that are still there. The parts manager, stuff like that. Obviously nobody else is there. Thinking on that, you know, being a service manager and thinking of, you know, when I'm hiring these express techs and thinking about when I was doing it and giving, you know, little to no opportunity to see, you know, most of the express techs walk in and they've got a 5-foot ceiling. That's it. This is where we're going to stick you in this box. Here's your lift. You're going to live and die right here. That's it. There's no path. There's no, hey, you know, you've got a 5-foot ceiling right now, but you've got computer, you've got classes to take, you know, in 6 months, we're going to do this as long as you've got your training done, you know, and then the ceiling goes to 8 feet, you know, in the last 2 or 3 years being manager at the different places I was at, you know, I would see that there would be people that, you know, for example, one of the places I was at, one guy had been there 3 years and had only done enough training to be able to do certifications for the dealership and certifications to do recalls. That was it. In 3 whole years, that's all. He said, well, they never told us that we were supposed to do training. I can believe that a little bit. But then I had a guy who came in with a good attitude, work ethic, and everything else, had the same amount of training plus more done in less than 30 days. So the guy with the 3 years, I'm sorry, but excuses don't go very far with me. You can't tell me that I can look at the former leadership or the ownership of the dealership or however, because I believe it's a burden on them. And I think I can blame them as well. But if you have no gas, if you have no give a shit, then yeah, of course you're just going to do the bare minimum. You're just going to do just enough what you need to do to be able to squeak by. But at that point, how useful are you really? And how are you benefiting yourself?
Exactly. That's the big question, right? Because this is one of the things that comes up regularly in coaching. Like, oh, I'm not making enough money. You know, they're not paying me to do this. They're not paying me to do MPIs. They're not paying me to do training. They're not, you know, like I, it's easy for me now because I've got, you know, yes, the data set is small. It's only roughly 500 technicians. It's about to be a bit more than that. I got another shop on the program right now that I'm going to get a whole bunch of technician surveys on top of that. So we're going to roll 500. But the consistency now across, I think I should really know this particular number off the top of my head, but I can't remember how many different brands I have, but I've got most of the brands covered now in terms of shops. I've got, I think, 12 states. Shop size has ranged from about one of the early ones when I was still doing smaller shops. I'm no longer doing smaller shops. They have to have a minimum of 13 technicians and up. But across all of those technicians, 500 plus, the training level and income has stayed like within such a minuscule margin that it hasn't really changed. And it's almost dead nuts on, right? Level one brand certified, completed. So your basic brand training, level one, done. 40 grand a year max out, right? They can bust ass all day long. And all the pay plans always end up around 40 grand a year at the end of the year. Level two certified, meaning they've got all of their intermediate level training complete, 60 grand a year max. With almost no exceptions in both, right? Almost no exceptions, irrespective of brand or state. And then level three complete, this is where it gets juicy, right? The minimum in income. Level three brand training complete, minimum income is 80 grand a year US, because this is all US data. Yeah. The average income in that category is $110,000 a year. So the people who are driven enough to realize that, hey, when I get training, hey, when this works, you know, all of the things that I'm doing and I'm being, you know, I'm communicating well, I'm getting trained, I'm taking on the training, da, 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 I make a whole lot more money. But it really is a pyramid, right? There's a whole lot of people on the bottom. There's a little bit of people in the middle, and there's not as much on top. And, you know, yes, that makes the average go up. But when you see that the average for levels, the difference between level three complete and level one complete is 2.5, almost 3 times the amount. Yeah. Right. And to understand that there are technicians, I have technicians that are level 3 complete that are only 3 years in.
Yeah.
So if you are an 18-year-old right now walking into a Chevy store or a Ford store, or not so much the Dodge stores, the Dodge stores tend to be a little bit lower, but the Chevy Ford, Honda, Toyota tech, if you're 18 in 3 years, if you can average 110 grand, get your level 3 training done in 3 years. It can be done, sometimes faster, sometimes a little bit slower, depending on what state you're in.
But depends on the, making, it also depends
could you,
on...
You go back to your 20-year-old self.
Man, you know, when I...
Could you imagine your 20-year-old self, Aaron, and make 110 grand? Can you imagine that?
When I think about myself at that age, I would probably put money on... And this is where it goes hand in hand. I would probably put money on... me not doing it. And there's a couple of different reasons why
do you say that?
So there's a couple of different reasons why, because a lot of it has to do with the person. Okay. If I think about the person that I was at that time, it's kind of a 50-50, I would say. I would probably say that, you know, if I didn't see the upside to it, or if I didn't see the goal, or if I didn't see, because when you think about a 20-year-old, how many 20-year-olds out there are very responsible, have a sense of accountability, are mature? You know, I look myself in the mirror a lot, okay? Look, kind of put it that way. And I have to be very, I live in reality, I have to be very real with myself. So when you ask me a question like that, Do I think that, you know, I would have, you know, first thing I probably would have said is, well, I don't have an opportunity here, so I'm going to have to go somewhere else to try to be able to get that opportunity. Would I have put the work in at that time? Probably not. Possibly not. And that's, you know, that's commentating on how I possibly perceive myself at that time. And mm-hmm. I mean, it could have went differently. You know, I did look at another dealership that was closer. And I remember talking to the manager there, and they wanted me to, as you know, with not enough training, with not enough tools, they wanted me to be, work in their express area as a flag rate technician. And I think at the time it was $15 an hour flag rate. And I was, uh-huh. you know, uneducated. I didn't understand, you know, how I understand it now. You know, if I could go back and tell myself, yes, hey, you need to jump on this. You need to get all your training done. You need to do this. You need to, you know, I probably would not have said it at a Ford store. I probably would have told myself, you need to go work at Toyota or Honda. Mm-hmm. Because hindsight, you see where, you know, the trouble that Ford is in right now. But anyways, I probably would have convinced myself that, you know, because it's not just when you think about work ethic, because I've got the work ethic, but when you think about I would probably say confidence. I would say the confidence in myself to be able to know that, you know, if I applied myself, I'd be able to get to that. And I probably would have needed a little bit more reassurance rather than a service advisor walking out there telling me he's going to get me fired every day, you know. And okay.
So let's dissect that a little bit. So time has passed since your 2021. As a quick, I appreciate you being transparent, because not many people are willing to be transparent and have a genuine conversation. So I appreciate that very much. What I think is interesting now is that I know you well enough now to know that you are a transparent person. I know you well enough now that you have the work ethic. Just the opening remarks here, we saw every Sunday morning at 7 a.m. Central, the only thing that we ever saw on SDL up until I can't remember how long ago it was until we started seeing the other side of your face. But every Sunday morning, we'd only see one side of your face because you were at the shop doing paperwork at 7. You were at the shop already doing paperwork at 7 a.m. So I know you have the work ethic. I know you have the integrity. I know you have the transparency. So at 20, so somewhere between then and now, something occurred for you to build enough confidence, to build enough trust in yourself, hold yourself accountable. Like you mentioned, like I regularly look at myself in the mirror, so to speak. What is, do you have a defining moment in there that did that? Or was there something or someone that helped you make that transition?
You know, that's kind of been an ongoing thing on my mind, when people, cause I have the Simon Sinek book, I have the Find Your Why, and mm-hmm. I really honestly have read very little of it, because when I just think about the title of the book, I'm not saying that I can understand what the book is saying, but when you want to get that confidence and you want to get that drive, you know, or like I said, that the gas, you have your give a shit. You know, there's a mm-hmm. lot of people out there that they want to do the bare minimum. And, you know, I'm not necessarily a bare minimum type of person. And I can tell you that my grandfather wrote out his life story, a portion of his 65 years of his life. And he talks mm-hmm. about his father, who was a massive alcoholic. And he worked at the Louisiana Bat Factory in Louisville, Kentucky. And the Louisville Sluggers, the bat. Mm-hmm. Anyways, he would, on his way home, he would drink. He would stop at a bar and drink half of his wages away every day. And at that time in the Depression, it really wasn't all that much compared to now. But at that time, it was food and rent. And so I, reading his book, he talks about when the police came with, people, I guess two guys. And he was probably about, I think, 8 to 10, somewhere around there. And mm-hmm. the sheriff and the two other guys beat up him and his brothers and sisters, beat up his mom, my great-grandmother, and threw them out of the house because they hadn't made rent, because my great-grandfather was spending it all on alcohol. So, you know, when you think about, you know, what is important to me? And if you've ever watched the movie Cinderella Man, it's a good movie. When you see the meaning behind it, you know, I don't work for the recognition. I don't work for, you know, the money is a tool. It is not, you know, money doesn't buy happiness. Money doesn't give you happiness. Money, you know, I've been happy, flat, broke, poor, no place to live. I've been happy, you know, and I've been happy having, you know, whatever things I have. But to be able to make sure that my family's taken care of, that, you know, there's a roof over our head, that there's food on the table, things like that, that is the why. And I think that, you know, reading about how difficult his life was for lots of different types of reasons, you know, it gives me that work ethic and that drive that, you know, I don't ever want to be in that position, you know, for one reason or another. And that, you know, in the future, I'm going to do what I need to do to be able to make sure that I'm in a position to not be in that position. You know,
gotcha.
You know, reading that, you know, and understanding a lot of where my grandfather came from, you know, it just kind of opens your eyes a little bit when you start thinking like, well, yeah, I mean, now Nowadays, that stuff doesn't necessarily really happen, but it did in the past. It absolutely did. And, you know, that was a, you know, that was a normal. The landlord wouldn't receive his money and call the police, and they would basically come physically throw you out of the house. So you, when you think about, you know,
side of that coin, you've got a business owner who's effectively, you know, I'm 3, 4, 5, however long it took them back then to say, you know, enough's enough. At the same time, you've got someone incredibly irresponsibly not taking care of their family, and it's the trickle down effect of everything that it does to the family is awful. Yeah. Absolutely awful, because now the person that's going to suffer the most is not necessarily your grandfather in that particular moment in time. It's children, and the children's children, yeah, that are going to suffer from that. Now, there's lots of lessons in there, and I'm glad that the lessons can be learned from it. It's awful that your family has had to go through that, but at the same time, you know, you can use those lessons for yourself, even though that you never had to experience it, you can still learn from it. And yeah, it sounds like amongst many other things, you can apply that to other portions of your life, that in, you know, how you at 20 wouldn't necessarily have had the drive and or ambition and or the understanding that you do now, but you now can apply a lot of those lessons you've learned since then till now. To make those changes, to prevent those things from happening, obviously not the awful stuff, because some of that's common sense stuff. But at the same time, you're talking about how you treat, you know, you've taken examples of how you were treated and say, I will not be that person. I am going to use this experience where I've been treated like absolute garbage, and it's like, okay, how do I treat these people so that I'm liked, but make sure that I'm treating them with respect, because I wasn't treated with respect. How do I talk to these people so that they are respected and they get the kind of communication that they need to be successful, right? In each step that you've gone through, right? So that's awesome. So given that circumstance, you know, over the last 20 years, beyond those, some of those awful stuff from 20 years ago, what's some of the big challenges that you've overcome, let's say in the last 5 years, that had, now we're going to remember the time and date that we are now. Think about the last 5 years. What is one of the biggest struggles you've had in the last 5 years that you've overcome that isn't the status quo question? Like, obviously technician shortage is a thing. Let's not talk about that. Let's talk about different challenges, something different. So what's something outside of the normal that you've had to overcome?
You know, I would probably think that it has been, you know, possibly personal consistency. You know, I made a decision in 2019, late 2019, that, you know, I wanted to be a manager. I was an advisor for close to 10 years. And I really honestly had enough of, you know, working for managers who, you know, understood portions of the numbers and, you know, were basically just, you know, just not up to the caliber that I thought that I could be at. And so I basically just made the determination to get into management, and, you know, I had a first go around and did not turn out great, but I wasn't going to quit. And I think that, you know, that adversity is one of those things that in the last 5 years, I think that has kind of fueled the fire a little bit. You know, people probably selling me a little bit short, you know, for probably good reason, you know, like I said, I kind of look at myself in the mirror a lot, you know, when you're starting to, you know, I'm a big accountability and responsibility type of person, especially when it comes to work. And, you know, I can't point fingers at other people when I know that, you know, I don't think that they are 100% responsible. And if I'm going to be the type of person that I would want to be, I'm not going to point the finger at somebody else when I know that it's completely within my power to be a better person. And, you know, the inconsistency, I took a job, I picked up from Texas, went to Indiana, and was a manager for a Chevrolet dealership for about a year and a half. And I think that it's been a little inconsistent since then. You know, I think that it's been good positions. I think that, you know, people don't like to see the kind of the jump around type of thing. And I don't really want to, not trying to change the topic or subject or anything like that. But as far as the, you know, the last 5 years, I would probably say it's been a little personal inconsistency. And I wouldn't say that it's necessarily, it's not necessarily, you know, the type of person that I really am. But I've just found that, you know, if I have a specific type of level that I want to work at, it's difficult to be able to find that out there. You know, when I see the whole time of what I got used to. And then when I decided that, you know what, I want to be different. I want to be better. I want to be the best. I want to, you know, get my game up to where it needs to get to. You know, there's work and there's time that it takes to be able to get to that point, depending on, you know, what type of store you're at, what kind of manufacturer you're working for. And, you know, that's also what makes me very patient. You know, but it takes time to be able to get that. You know, I always looked at it, you know, as a, you know, you got a wrinkled shirt. It takes time to iron that out and make it right. And that's the way I look at it. It's not something easy because I hate ironing. It's just something that I just absolutely hate to do. That's why God invented dryers. So anyways,
you're not wrong.
Yeah. You know, but it just, I would probably say personal inconsistency. And, you know, I really honestly hate to say that. It really bothers me a lot, you know, but like I said, I'm also very patient. I have to be accountable for the decisions I make. And, you know, some of the decisions I don't make, you know, unfortunately, the position I'm in right now, it was not necessarily my decision, but I certainly am. I think I am better off and I'm grateful for where I'm at and grateful for the journey, you know, the experience. I can't say that, you know, it was all bad. I really honestly can't, you know,
learn from all of those steps, right?
You got to learn from it. And that's the thing that some people miss the point on when they start regretting things that happened in the past, or they, you know, don't like something that happened then. Okay. Yeah. But what did you take away from it? If you took away from it, you learned something and made a change, and you can do that in the beginning or towards the end, and it helps you make a better decision in the future, was it really all that bad?
No, that's exactly right. And I think one of the things that in my career that I would say, one of my biggest pet peeves, if it's not my biggest pet peeve as an employed person, and even as irrespective from the vendor side of things, when I'm dealing with somebody, one of my biggest pet peeves is a lack of decision making or a slow decision maker. Right. I'm not a patient person. I understand that. That is one thing that I will endlessly have to work on. I am not a patient person. But I do know that one of the things that builds trust between people and between teams is a leader's ability to make decisions and make decisions quickly. And the secondary portion of that is being willing to fail based on that decisions, and then holding yourself accountable to making that decision.
Yeah, but to me, a lot of leaders out there, they don't a lot of leaders, they don't want to make those decisions because if it does fail, they don't want to have to deal with that.
You're right. Now, this is interesting. Now, hopefully I can remember this is actual case study done at Harvard, and this is a little bit interesting here. So the case study was done with art students and design students. And what they did is they had two groups. And one group, they were told, okay, I think it was like a vase or something like that. Like build a pot for flowers or whatever. And the idea was it's, you know, from concept to design to manufacturing to business. Like the idea was like a whole product start to finish kind of concept. And the idea was, what's faster? Spend 89 days of 90 days thinking and designing the product and then making it and putting it to market? Or is it better to make a lot of, and the second group was make a lot of products, keep trying to figure out what the best way is by the end of 90 days. And somewhere at the end of it, and I'm inferring in here, and hopefully maybe the tone of my voice will give away the answer here, but the group that literally made example after example after example after example, try, fail, try, fail, try, fail, try, fail across the 90 days, not only did they make a better product, but they ended up making more profit at the end because the design ended up being better. There's going to be less failures at the end because they've already figured out 99.9% of the failures that are going to happen with that product. Not only did they figure out new and more creative ways to manufacture the product, so it's going to be even cheaper to make, thus more profit. So it's actually in a leader's best interest to make decisions faster and fail than it is to take a lot of time to think about a decision, take even longer to make the decision, and then make the decision. It's way more profitable and way faster to just keep making decisions, right? Over and over and over and over again. Now, obviously, there's risk mitigation in there that you have to take into account. You know, finances, you can take, like, there's all of the things you do have to take into account. Yes, I want you all to think about stuff, but it's actually in your best interest to make decisions faster. So when I hear someone's like, oh, you know, the common sales vernacular is like, oh, I got to ask my wife, or, you know, oh, I got to go ask my business partner. Oh, I got to go ask the other service managers in the group, or I have to go. I understand, like, some of those are absolute non-negotiables. I understand that. But if you're just saying that when you don't really need to do that and you can make a decision on the spot, it's like, okay, this sounds good. Okay, let's try it. Like, what it doesn't matter whether you're talking about a new product, doesn't matter, new service, new solution, new tool, whatever the case may be. Most companies across the board, now there are exceptions, like large enterprise software solutions, like say it's 3 years and it's $150,000 a year, blah, 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 blah. Obviously, that is not something you make a quick decision on. But there's lots of solutions and tools and resources out there that you can send it back after 30 days, right? Yeah. Sometimes 90 days. Right? Many don't have commitments. Many don't have contracts. Right? It's like, hey, give us 30 days. Hey, give us 90 days. If you don't like it, sayonara. Very little commitment required. Very little outlay required. Let's try something out. Tools. Right? Tools. If you don't like something after 30 days, many of them will take it back. Like, obviously, you haven't beat the living. As long as you haven't mangled it to all get out, yeah, they're going to take it back. Right? So, make decisions faster, I would suggest, is one of the things I would suggest out of all of that. And that comes to maybe my last question here, Aaron. You've got a lot of little learnings and little bit tidbits in there that I think a lot of folks can take away from. But what would be your one piece of advice for a mechanic to help them be happier, healthier, more productive tomorrow?
That's difficult. You know, a lot of times it depends on the situation or the, you know, the topic of that. But I would probably say, um, And you'll like this. It'll help you out. Patience is the weapon for deception. If you think at any time, if you think that any time something,
like that.
If something is too good to be true, give it a minute. Give it just a minute. You don't, you know, I agree making decisions fast is a good thing. But I think that, you know, I heard that a long time ago. And when you sit there and actually really think about it, you know, let's take, you know, I kind of said it a minute ago, but let's take Ford for a second. Okay. When you think about it, should they have waited on their jump in on EVs? Absolutely. If they had been a little bit more patient on it, because you already saw Tesla's learning the hard way, Fisker, Toyota. Toyota was already smart about it. They weren't, you know, Apple jumped out. And I don't even want to know how much money Apple spent on research and development for their car, because I know for a fact that at one point they had a contract with Hyundai and were working partners to be able to make a prototype electric vehicle with Hyundai. I'm sure that went nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about it, Ford, if they would have taken, you know, and I know that they're, what they're trying to do is they're trying to corner the market a little bit. They're trying to make a bigger name for themselves. If they had had a little bit more patience, they would have figured it out that, you know, what they said at one point that they wanted, that they saw by calculations or speculation or, you know, living in a, you know, fantasy land, that they thought that 50% of their sales soon, within the next, you know, 5 years, were going to be EVs. That is completely wrong. There's no way that's going to happen. If they had been a little bit more patient, they probably would have seen that was not going to happen. More
patient. I love that. I love that. And I love that conversation about EVs. I know there's a lot of big proponents out there for EVs. You know, there's a lot of very, very outspoken folks out there about EVs, that it's the next new wave and da 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 da. I have never been one of those people. I will never be one of those people. I think Tesla is awesome in what they've accomplished, right? I think it's absolutely amazing what they've accomplished. I think, you know, if you go online and you look at some of the stuff that's being done across the board in small batches, like you look at Rimac and what they're doing, like some of the Richard Hammond crashed one, some several million euro car off the side of a cliff and crashed one, and it burned for 3 days. And he almost didn't survive again because of what the car is capable of doing. But I've not said, and I won't ever say, and now it's coming to light, some of the stuff that I've been saying for years, absolutely years, that alternative fuels are going to be, I believe, then, and I continue to believe now, and it seems to be reinforced, that alternative fuels are going to be what pushes us forward. Because after over 100 years, 140 years of the internal combustion engine, now that we have gasoline, diesel, propane, natural gas, and now hydrogen as a fully formed thing that can all be pumped directly into an ICE motor, the thing that we've been producing for 100 and some odd years, that becomes a viable option.
Yeah.
And the only concern, just like EVs, is range. Guess what? EV goes out the window. When you have a non-renewable resource that is incredibly difficult to mine, incredibly difficult to ship, it's unsafe in the vehicle in large quantities. And if anybody out there watched the, was it the Hummer? I think it was the Hummer. No. It was the Rivian truck. The Rivian truck going into guardrails, like it was being sent into guardrails at like 60 miles an hour. And this 8,000-9,000-pound truck with all this battery weight down low just cruises right through guardrails like it's butter, right? These are not great things to be on our highways. I know that personally, there are racetracks across the planet that are saying no to EVs, period. Because they do not have the resources in order to keep the drivers of these cars safe.
Did you see Did you see the EV that caught fire on the transport ship?
Oh yes, that's an. It wasn't a Porsche. It was a Porsche container.
There's
400 Porsches at the bottom of the ocean somewhere.
Yeah, you know the funny thing was one of the guys they interviewed one of the guys that owned one of the cars on the ship. You know how long he'd been waiting for his car? Uh-huh. A year and a half.
I don't want it.
And it's at the bottom of the ocean right now. Can you imagine?
Well, folks, hey,
my car's gonna be here in 3 days. Oh, well, now it's at the bottom of the ocean. So I know you've been waiting a year and a half.
I have to say, I love driving EVs. I've been in lots of them now, and yeah. I think in a lot of ways they're really amazing. But I don't think they're the next wave. I think alternative fuels and the multidisciplinary ways that we can utilize alternative fuels is kind of the way things are going to go. And on that bombshell, I think it's a great way to end today. I appreciate your time, Aaron.
Oh, you're welcome. And just give it time. I think that eventually what you're going to see is someone's going to have a hybrid hydrogen-powered engine with a battery backup. I think that'll be the next kind of idea that somebody's going to have, because then they can say, well, we can have something that's a little bit cleaner, a little bit easier, mm-hmm. plus it's going to be a hybrid. And I wouldn't be surprised if it was Toyota. I would not be
surprised.
They have
the Mirai.
Yeah.
They have the Mirai that's testing in California, if I'm not mistaken. Don't quote me on that one, but I'm pretty sure that the Mirai, I might be saying it wrong, but they've got a small batch of hydrogen hybrids, if I'm not mistaken, out in California. So it's they're between Volkswagen, not Volkswagen, between Toyota and BMW. I think they've pretty much washed out full on hardcore EVs as a primary source. They're still going to have the Prius. I think the Prius is going to be a thing forever, but the Prius is not designed as a full-size sedan replacement. It's meant to be an in-town electric car. It's not meant to go 700 kilometers in 1 month.
It's also tested. It's been
through its paces. Well, that's true. I think 01 was the first one, if I'm not mistaken.
Somewhere around there.
Well, anyway, I think that's enough data download for the folks here today, don't you guys think? So I think that's how we're going to end off today's Wrench Turners episode. But that's okay, folks, because there is another one coming next week. Now, folks, don't forget, Wrench Turners podcast comes out every week. We'll have another 10mm Mastery coming out here probably in the next week or so. We're going to do a recording. We're going to get a big old batch and do a whole big batch of 10 mils for you guys. It's been far too long since you've seen the lads get together, so watch out for that. Wrenches for Wrenches newsletters, still bi-weekly, fresh and new. However, I'm pulling stuff from the archives. Last week, I don't know when this is specifically going to come out, but last week I pulled one from the archives. I think it was series 5 or edition 5 we were talking about. It got re-released, so you guys can read it. And also, Wrench Turners merch. My mother says it's comfortable. It fits any sizes. It goes from extra small to 3XL for those folks like me who like to get extra big size hoodies. All the sizes, shipping is all US as well, so don't worry about that. And our last quote of the day. Now, last week I had a great quote. I found it last minute, but it didn't really suit. And I got a couple of comments. Don't forget, you can send me feedback. A couple of comments that didn't really suit, but this week I think I got one that's right on point. Okay? Keep breathing, because stopping will be the worst business decision you ever make. It makes sense for this past week. Anyways, folks, remember, negative pushes, positive pulls, and always clean your toys before you put them away.